A podcast of the cinema. A late podcast of the cinema.
Well, you know, here's the situation.
Well, first of all, you're Dave White.
Sure. That is what I am.
And I'm Alonzo Duralde.
You're the film reviews editor for The Wrap. You're on What the Flick. You're on the Who Shot Ya podcast on the Maximum Fun Network.
Yes.
I sometimes write reviews for The Wrap. Mostly, I make dinner.
You are
also. I'm currently making sure my tea is just right.
You are a credentialed and experienced film critic.
That is a fact. I mean, I am. I'm just not out there writing a million reviews every week like I used to be.
Right. But you're doing this show.
I'm doing this show and three others, and handling all the Patreon merch.
That's a full-time gig.
That's my full-time gig. And now I have just the right amount of honey in my tea, and you're in the sunken place.
And I need a little sugar in my bowl.
Do you feel like you're in the sunken place now that I've been stirring my tea just the right way?
You don't
to put you into the sunken place?
You don't have the scrape.
Oh.
That Catherine Keener manages, yeah.
I don't got the scrape. How you like that?
You're not going to put me in the sunken place, so don't even try. Every day, it's the same thing. Are you in the sunken place yet? No, I'm not in the sunken place. Stop it.
It's going to work one day. And then you'll be
in the sunken place.
In the sunken place. I don't know what I'm going to be doing.
Yeah, and then
or,
what?
With or to you once you're in the sunken place, but you're going to be there, and it's going to be major.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's great.
I had the weirdest. I just got back from the laundromat. This is a
go on.
This is a big day. I just got back from the laundromat, and getting home. Our laundromat is literally a 3-minute drive.
Yes,
from our apartment. I would walk there if it weren't for the fact that I would have to
carry
the
laundry,
giant
yes.
hamper with me. So, I finish and I get out and I'm driving down Willoughby to get home, you know, the back way.
Yeah.
A fire hydrant has burst. All the streets are flooded.
Oh.
It's chaos. People are backed up, honking at each other, trying to get around it, through it, backing up away from it. No one's helping anyone else to make
awkward
this
U-turns, I'm
easier,
sure. Yeah.
Of course. People are inconvenienced and angry. And when Los Angeles drivers are inconvenienced and angry, they begin running stop signs and over people. So it took me a good 15-minute drive to get home.
Oh, my.
Around all the nonsense. So it's 9:45 a.m. and I'm at my wit's end already.
You just drink your tea.
Nobody come for me.
We'll talk about the current cinema, and I'm sure that will calm you down. So, LA Film Critics voted over the weekend.
Oh, yeah. You people. So, Saturday night, this is funny. Saturday night, we're at a birthday party. Manola's there.
Mm-hmm.
And she starts talking to you about the voting. And then quickly...
Manola Dargis, the New York Times.
Quickly turns her head to me and says... Are you voting in LAFCA tomorrow? I go, F no. She's like, you're not in LAFCA? I was like, no.
You make me take that bullet just so you can enjoy the screeners without having to do anything.
Why in God's name would I join LAFCA? I get every benefit that they offer via you.
For the spirited discussions and camaraderie?
I already have too many friends. And until one of them dies, I couldn't possibly take on another.
No, the voting meeting is actually always kind of interesting because the best part is always there are movies that people like, but just don't, they either aren't high enough on people's list or not enough people saw them or whatever, but somebody will sort of, you know, it's a tiered voting system. So the first round you have like your 3 points, 2 points, 1 point in whatever category. And a lot of times people will sort of, you know, madly dash off their 1 point to just a movie that they loved, but has no chance in hell of, you know, getting anywhere. And other people,
why wouldn't you give your favorite that 3-pointer?
Because you're throwing your vote in the street. That's why.
That's what everyone should do.
So anyway,
Sierra Nevada, all the votes.
Every so often, somebody would do a 1 point, and this happened to me once too. I did a 1 point for, I think it was like Gemma Arterton in the best actress category for Their Finest.
That's right.
And several people in the room went,
like, because back when they were young and pure in their hearts, they would have given her their 3 points.
Here's the thing, though. That's not necessarily the case. It could also be that, oh, yeah, she's really good in that movie. But this is a year where I got like 6 actresses ahead of her. Because, you know, it's a really competitive year this year for actress and supporting actress.
All right.
There were a ton of choices. So it's not just that people are being like callously calculating in terms of how they vote.
Yes, it is.
No, I don't think so. I think.
I know how you people are.
I think, look, you think that we are too safe.
I believe, as a group, I would say that.
But,
and I don't care who in LAFCA is listening and doesn't like what I just said.
But you realize that.
How do you like me now?
LAFCA's rep is that actually we're contrarian.
Oh?
Yeah.
Contrarian to who?
Well, to Oscar pundits who have no... Okay. Whose only real interest in these awards...
That's not a real measuring stick.
I know that, but I'm just saying. Right. Because, like, last year we voted for, Adam Driver in Patterson and not Casey Affleck in Manchester by the Sea.
Right.
It's like, oh, LAFCA, always got to be different. Always got to make waves.
Always got to make waves.
Go their own way. I mean, come on. We.
I know what you're going to say, but say it anyway.
How many best actresses have we given in the last decade to, like, Koreans or that French woman in that movie that nobody saw about the crazy artist?
You were talking about the woman who starred in the film Mother.
Well, for the Koreans, yes.
But Korean actress whose name, Kim Hye-ja, who was the lead in Bong Joon-ho's Mother.
Okay.
2009 film.
Yes, in a 3-year period, we gave best actress...
Mother without the exclamation
point. Yeah, exactly. We gave best actress to Yolande Moreau for Seraphine.
Yes, which is a fantastic movie. If you've not seen Seraphine... please do. It's just terrific.
Then Kim Hye-ja for Mother, and then the next year, Yoon Jung-hee for Poetry.
Yeah.
So shut up, Dave Weiss.
Oh, you know what?
Don't act like we're just the Hollywood Foreign Press or something.
You're not the Hollywood Foreign Press. You're not
We give interesting awards to cool people in movies
contrarian.
That nobody saw.
You guys are progressive and forward-thinking. And those are wonderful choices that you made with those 3 actresses. You can do better.
Oh, bite me.
You can keep doing better.
You can keep biting me.
Keep doing better. Sierra Nevada.
Then you know what? Then that is why you should join.
That is why you should join, so the
Dave White Stir the Turd Award can be established.
When my favorite things of the year are not recognized, you guys are wrong.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
That's what I'm talking
about.
Okay,
you may commence zipping it then.
I'm going to unzip it right now.
For a room full of consensus, I think we still come up with some interesting choices.
You're right, you do. Let me give appreciation to LAFCA for the good things they do.
You are being a real B, C, and D right now. You're the whole alphabet.
Okay. No, it's fine. LAFCA's great. I go to the dinner every year. I meet weird people.
You will be pleased to know.
Yes.
I have not signed up to present anything to anyone this year.
Good.
Because I know how you hate that.
I don't want to be at a table with any celebrities.
I know.
Don't like it.
I know.
Unless it's Catherine Keener. She can sit at our table because she's a gas.
True.
She proved herself to be a delight and a fun a total dude. She's great. But I'm going to unzip it right now for Loveless. I'm going to get it out of the way.
Oh,
right now.
Okay, I was going to talk about this year's LAFCA vote, but...
Oh, you're going to talk about more votes? We're going to keep on about LAFCA?
I barely started yet.
Oh, all right. I'll shut up then and not interrupt you, and you tell me all the information.
Okay. I was going to zip through the categories real quick, because I think you'll be interested to know what the contenders were. So, all right, we gave a cinematography to Shape of Water, with runner-up being Blade Runner 2049, but also Love in the Room for Dunkirk and Mudbound and Call Me By Your Name and Florida Project. You don't have to not talk during this, by the way.
I'm being very quiet and not interrupting.
We gave score to Phantom Thread, and runner-up was Shape of Water, but also a lot of votes for Marjorie Prime. I thought that, you know, I'm glad people remember that one. Supporting actor Willem Dafoe, runner-up was Sam Rockwell. A lot of, one of those categories where there were a gajillion people that came up, but Woody Harrelson, Jason Mitchell from Mudbound, and Barry Keoghan, and Michael Stuhlbarg, you can Call Me By Your Name. Production design was Blade Runner 2049 with Shape of Water as the runner-up. A lot of divvied out votes beyond that. Call Me By Your Name, probably the... and Phantom Thread were probably the closest behind them. We gave editing to Dunkirk with runner-up I, Tanya. Some love for Jane, the documentary, for Good Time, Florida Project, and The Post. Supporting actress Laurie Metcalf with runner-up Mary J. Blige for Mudbound. Definitely some love in the room for Allison Janney, as well as Lois Smith and Tiffany Haddish.
Cool.
Doc, Faces Places, with runner-up Ex Libris, which I was very happy about because those were my two favorite docs this year. Jane was up there too, as well as Dawson City Frozen Time. Screenplay went to Get Out with runner-up Three Billboards Outside Billings, Outside Ebbing, Missouri, sorry. Lady Bird was up there as well. Animated film Breadwinner with Coco as a runner-up, and some love for Lego Batman and In This Corner of the World. Foreign film was a tie between...
Christy voted for Captain Underpants.
She did, so did I. Yeah. Not as my top, but it was in there.
That's why it lost.
Yes, I guess so. Yeah. We were the only ones. Foreign film was a tie between BPM, which we both liked, and Loveless, which you're about to talk about.
Yes.
Beyond that, a very divided category because there's just so much stuff. And
what were the who read me the foreign language stuff that people voted for? Just okay. Give me the list. What do you got?
There was some love for,
because you know that's my jam.
I know it's hard for me to read my own handwriting.
yeah, you're telling me
something. FW Raw got some love.
The Cannibal Movie.
Yes.
Which I still haven't seen.
I still haven't seen either. I need to. Graduation, Foxtrot.
I thought Graduation was 2016. I swear I don't remember it coming out this year.
It was at Cannes in 2016, but it opened here this year.
Oh. Well, you know me. I'm on Cannes.
Of course, yes. Since you always go. The Square.
I dig The Square.
And those are probably the only ones that got more than like 15 or 20 votes.
What are the other ones? What do people just throw out?
After the Storm.
After the Storm.
Song.
That was very good.
Song of Granite.
Uh-huh.
A Journey Through French Cinema.
Uh-huh. That was long.
Thelma, A Taxi Driver, Keddy, The Insult, The Wound, Dearest Sister, A Week and a Day. Stefan Zweig. My handwriting is really terrible. Menasha, which is a foreign language film, even though it's an American production.
Yes.
Okja, Endless Poetry, Mr. Universe, 1945, Happy End, The Death of Louis XIV, The Ornithologist, In the Fade, Nocturama.
Nocturama is stunning.
There were a couple
people, and problematic.
I would say there were people that voted for it, and there were people near me that went, France, the Francois Ozon movie, which I was not a big fan of.
Yeah.
So yeah, a whole bunch of stuff.
All right.
Yeah. Best actor, Timothy Chalamet with James Franco as a runner up. A lot of votes for Daniel Kaluuya from Get Out, and for Daniel Day-Lewis in Phantom Thread.
Right.
Best actress, Sally Hawkins, with Frances McDormand as a runner-up. A lot of votes for Saoirse Ronan. And for, you'll be glad to know, Cynthia Nixon.
Oh, yeah.
For A Quiet Passion.
Oh, yeah, because she was amazing.
Also, Margot Robbie. Best director was a tie between Luca Guadagnino and Guillermo del Toro. But right. A lot of votes for Dee Reese, for Sean Baker, and for Greta Gerwig.
Right.
Best picture, Call Me By Your Name, with Florida Project as a runner-up, but also a lot of support for Lady Bird, for Get Out, and Shape of Water. And then I'm also just talking about Next Generation, so
it's a secret.
Yes, I mean that's one where we don't announce even the runner-up. Like we just we have our winner, who is Greta Gerwig, and that's it.
Okay, so Russian filmmaker Andrei, oh God, his last name. Here's the thing. Hey, I know we have like at least three listeners
in Mother Russia.
In Russia, help me with how to say this man's name.
Spell it out.
Because it is impossible for me to say. His last name is spelled Zvyagintsev.
Zvyagintsev.
Okay. That's how I'm saying it.
The famous Teddy Z.
He directed Leviathan.
Yeah.
Which I believe won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language the year it came out a couple years ago.
Definitely nominated.
Incorrect.
Film I did not love.
And, no, I guess it was not. I guess it did not win that. I thought it did. I guess it was nominated.
Yes.
He directed also two earlier films that I really like, Elena and The Return. Now, this film is almost impossible for you to see in the United States right now, unless you live in New York City or near New York City, and you get out to the theater that's showing it during its 1 week Academy Award qualifying run.
But
it's going to be released early 2018
by Sony Pictures Classics.
By Sony Pictures Classics, which means it's going to be in art houses all across the United States.
Yes.
So in early 2018, you get yourself to the art house, you'll be able to see this.
So we're not going to get super deep.
I'm not
going to
talk about it for very long today. We're going to wait until it's released so that everybody who's listening actually has a chance. Now, if you live in New York, you can do it. But you have like 3 days left.
Yeah. Go, go, go.
Yeah. It's perhaps not the most uplifting film to see right now during this holiday season.
Or ever.
Especially in the United States. Especially in the United States right now, which is not having an especially uplifting anything.
Or a particularly warm relationship with Russia, for that matter.
Or apparently, yeah, that as well. You know who I have a warm relationship with?
Who?
The people in Russia who sell vintage Soviet Christmas ornaments on eBay.
Yes.
Boy, y'all are the best. You're probably not listening.
No,
but
the best are our listeners in Russia.
Okay, sure. You're the best. You're the first best. The second best are the people who sell old Soviet Christmas ornaments on eBay. Because I bought a good three from various locations in that gigantic country.
Why did the Soviets celebrate Christmas?
You got me, but someone kept making Christmas tree ornaments.
Okay.
And they're delightful. We got that little cosmonaut.
Mm-hmm.
We got a little rose. We got that multicolored pine cone. All of them beautiful. And arrived unbroken.
Yes.
Sometimes in boxes, secured with nothing but twine. So I have a very warm relationship with those people. That has nothing to do with this film.
Nope.
This film is a straight-up bummer.
Really, a film called Loveless? Who would have guessed?
Well, you know what I thought when I first saw the title? I thought, oh, that he named it after that My Bloody Valentine album.
No, he named it after that place in Nashville where you get the really good chicken and biscuits.
He named it after the relationship between all humans in this film. It's the story of a husband and wife played by Mariana Spivak and Alexi Rosen. Alexi Rosen was in
Leviathan?
Elena and Leviathan. Hmm. Although looking different because now he's got a big sexy beard. So they play a husband and wife who are getting divorced. They have a kid who's about 11 or 12. And these two people are so toxic and horrible that neither one of them wants custody of the kid. The opening moments of this film are these two fighting over who has to take the kid. And it's late at night, and the kid is awake and hears them. And then the kid disappears. And so the husband and wife have to spend the remainder of the film banding together to try to find the kid. But kind of half-heartedly, it's awful. They are the awfulest people. At one point, the mother says, I just should have aborted it. And that's like that's a run-of-the-mill line of dialogue between these two. They despise each other, and they do not like their kid. And when he disappears, they're angry about
being put out by having to go look for him.
Kinda.
Oh God.
Yeah.
So I guess this doesn't end with a musical number.
No. It's a tough film, and you will feel sort of maybe crushed by it when it's over. It's very good. Maybe a little obvious near the end. Showing me things very prominently.
Right.
That I already knew.
Right.
You know, it never tells you anything.
Sure.
It just kind of shows you stuff again and again. You see them behaving in ways that are clearly selfish.
Yeah.
Many times,
right.
But it's often the same action. I won't say exactly what it is.
So this is a movie that should have taken off a piece of jewelry before leaving the
kinda
apartment.
Yeah, yeah, but still overall very good and just, you know, grim.
All right.
So Merry Christmas, everybody.
Can't wait to watch that one.
Loveless. And in February in February, when winter is really gross and everyone's unhappy, that's when it comes out.
Naturally. Summertime fun. Well, let's lift the mood a bit. Also only showing in New York, but most definitely coming out to a place near you sooner rather than later as the award season continues, is The Shape of Water.
Which is beautiful and lovely.
A delight.
Why don't you talk about that?
Sure. It's the latest from Guillermo del Toro. A director that I run very hot and cold with. I think he's got some terrific movies and other ones that not mean much to me. But this is probably my favorite film of his since Pan's Labyrinth. Sally Hawkins stars as a mute woman in the 1950s who has a very routine life. She works as a cleaning woman at a sort of secret science lab. She has a gay illustrator neighbor played by Richard Jenkins who narrates the film because she's mute. And, you know, the days sort of bleed into one another, the same thing over and over and over again. One day, a mysterious object arrives at the lab, and it turns out to be what is credited as the Amphibian Man, played by Doug Jones, who has played his share of Amphibian Men for Guillermo del Toro. He was Abe Sapien in the Hellboy movies. While the Amphibian Man is locked up and stuck in a glass cage of water, Sally Hawkins' character sort of begins to reach out with him, and they fall in love with each other. And she hatches a plan to liberate him from this laboratory with, you know, her fellow outsiders, including Jenkins and Octavia Spencer, who plays another cleaning woman. But they come up against the ruthless government guy played by who else? Michael Shannon.
Just kind of a grown-up, sexy Free Willy.
Yeah, I was thinking more along the lines of like Creature from the Black Lagoon, King Kong, a lot of movies where there's this sort of subtext of the lady and the monster romance. But yeah, it's emotionally fulfilling, and at the same time it is a movie that's about what we love about movies, and that can be really tedious if you do it wrong. If it's just like, hey, movies are great and we love escapism. But this movie manages to work in not just a lot of familiar imagery from monster movies, but from silent cinema, from musicals, a lot of different things. And I adore it. I love this movie.
I think it's really, really beautiful. And I watched it on the awards screener.
Yes.
That you got sent.
I will see it again
and
with
I
you.
I will absolutely over Christmas
see it projected
when we have some free downtime. I will be going to a screen to watch it again, because I think it's really just stunning to look at.
Yes.
And just, a movie can win me with its color story.
Oh, yeah.
And
this has more new look green than any movie I've ever seen.
I want to live in this film's
color story
environment. Yeah. That apartment is just this.
It's 1961, so things are still kind of mid-century looking.
Well, no, they live in an old building.
Right, I think about the cars and stuff.
It's the 60s, but they live in an old building.
They
live right over a movie theater where they can hear the film over and over and over again all the time, which I thought was actually a fun little touch. I think Sally Hawkins is tremendous in this film. I think Richard Jenkins is really good. Mm-hmm. The Doug Jones is the creature.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really expressive. I know people don't give. He's not motion capture, is he? He's in a real costume.
He's
right?
In a real costume. Right. There might be some motion capture as far as like, I remember he has like gills or something.
Right.
But I'd say for the most part, I think it's mostly practical.
People don't give awards for this kind of performance, but this guy deserves to be recognized.
Yeah.
For what he accomplishes here. It's just, you know, and it, there are moments where it makes no sense, and there are moments that are disturbing and dark, particularly because Michael Shannon is here.
Yes.
And he tends to bring that element with him wherever he goes. I love it.
Somebody was saying recently,
and every frame looks like, you know, your favorite scene.
Yeah.
It's so gorgeous.
It is.
Yeah.
Somebody, I think in one of the Flophouse Facebook group or somebody was saying that like Michael Stuhlbarg is having the best career right now.
Yeah.
Because he's in everything.
He's never the star of anything except that Coen Brothers film.
Right. A Serious Man. Yeah,
but he's in all the good ones.
He's in all the good movies, but he's also like, he's in the Marvel Universe, you know, and he just pops up in all these places. And, you know, he was so great on Fargo this year. Like, he shows up, and you're like, oh, yeah. You know, there's going to be at least one great thing in this movie, and it's going to be Michael Stuhlbarg.
Yep.
Yeah, I adore this movie. It absolutely
now, is it playing wide. Yet?
No, it's only in New York. It was on two screens in New York. I think it opens in L.A. this Friday.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was already here.
New. Nope.
Well, it's in our house.
That's right. And you know, won quite a bit of stuff from LAFCA. So
yet another film that y'all can't look at yet unless you're in New York.
Right. But like I said.
Soon Los Angeles and then soon the rest of the
country.
Soon
everywhere else. Yeah.
All right.
As I said at the beginning of this segment when you weren't listening to me. It's going
to
be getting around. So yes, people
will
absolutely.
I was trying to get down to the last of my tea before I got
People cold. Will absolutely have a chance to see this. And Yeah, it's, you know, I have to make my top 10 list next week, and this one is very certainly hovering near the top. Oh, hi.
Oh, hi, doggy.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. I didn't recognize you.
You're my favorite customer.
I didn't know it was you. Explain the disaster artist.
Sure.
To anyone who might not yet know.
Okay.
It's a convoluted story.
Yeah. All right. Once upon a time, there was a movie that just popped up in Los Angeles. And nobody...
2003-ish. That sounds right. Yeah. I remember the billboard.
I was just going to say, nobody was quite sure what it was, but there was a huge billboard for it with a very unusual leading man photographed on it.
Looking very serious.
Yes.
Almost dangerously serious.
And then every day in the LA Times and in Variety and in the Hollywood Reporter, there would be ads for this movie. And there were quotes that said things like two thumbs up or a drama in the vein of Tennessee Williams.
With no attribution.
With no attribution as to who said those things.
Right.
That movie was called The Room.
Mm-hmm.
It was four-walled into a theater, and it played for 2 weeks to qualify for the Academy Awards.
And it was like the Lemley Monica or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, one of the Lemley theaters, yeah. where you know, a lot of theaters do this, but very much in Los Angeles, you go to these smaller art house theaters and say, I'm going to pay to, basically, I'm going to rent this theater for a week, and I'm going to show my movie.
You're going to show my movie in this theater, yeah, as though someone else had picked it up for distribution and showed it.
Exactly.
And it's my way of tricking everybody
into thinking
this is a film that was worthy of being in a movie
right.
theater.
Right, and I'll take whatever box office there is, but you get paid, you know, whatever it is you charge people
for this
rental.
Yeah.
So The Room played.
That's what four-walling means.
Exactly. Okay. The room played. Very few people saw it. It went away.
And I was post iFilm.
Don't get ahead of us. We haven't. Oh, okay. Sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Continue. I know where I'm going.
Okay.
I was post iFilm.
Yes.
But pre-movies.com.
So you didn't have to.
So I was freelancing for various people, writing movie reviews for some local newspapers and this is a gay newspaper that was local and. E-Online, you know,
right.
with no credit, like no byline, those kind of reviews. We, the entire staff of E-Online, went to see this film, and we did not like it. So anyway, I didn't have to go see it, and it smelled funny to me.
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't have time or energy, so I missed it during its
week. Yeah, I never saw it. And now, mind you, Dave and I, there have been other movies, like most particularly Dangerous Men, where we have friends who make it a point to try and see everything, and then they will flag something for us, like, oh my God, you guys, drop everything and go see this. But nobody did that for us for The Room. I was kind of obsessed with it just because the ads every day were making me crazy, and my friend Tom, who at the time was working at a studio, so he was also reading the trades every day, we would call each other or email each other every day. I'm like, oh my God, what is the deal with this ad? And we never cracked the mystery of The Room. Cut to a few months later, I'm at the Arclight waiting to go see, waiting for some friends. We were going to go see It's a Mad, 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 Mad World at the Dome. And there was Tommy Wiseau in the courtyard trying to get people to come see The Room. He had apparently booked a house for one showing at the Arclight that day.
One show, one screen. Yeah.
And, you know, I believe if I didn't have a ticket for something else, I would have gone. But I was like, oh, my God. It's
so you were curious enough to go.
Yes. Right. So then a few months after that, I'm coming back from, I went to, I think, a Studio Ghibli movie on the UCLA campus. And I made the mistake of taking Sunset Boulevard on a Saturday night.
That's stupid.
Why'd that you was do stupid. That? Well, it was a learning experience. I never did it again.
Don't you do that anymore.
So I'm stuck in traffic. And I get stuck in front of the Key Club. And the Key Club has one of those digital billboards that has various ads sort of cycling through.
Right.
One of those ads is for The Room.
Yeah.
And it has a phone number.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't moving.
You were stuck in traffic, so you wrote it down.
No, I had my phone on me, and I wasn't moving, so I just called.
Okay.
And it was an RSVP to a screening that was coming up like that Saturday or
something. Was it a human voice?
It was Tommy's voice on the other side.
Oh, nice.
And so I RSVP'd, and it wasn't even at an actual theater. It was at the Wilshire Screening Room, where, you know, we go to a lot of movies for, you know, just pre-screenings for work. So Tom and I go, and we get literally the last seat left. And luckily, this was back when they still had those comfy chairs in the back row.
And y'all shared one.
We shared one.
What, was he on your lap or something?
No, we made it work.
That's some cuddle time.
I was thinner then.
Not that much thinner.
So we're in there, and the crowd is really enthusiastic.
Yeah.
They're really excited to be there.
What, a year later?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we're thinking, oh God, is this some sort of like Scientology recruitment thing we've stumbled into? Are we in a cult now? Is the door going to be locked? What is happening? Because everybody was just so thrilled to be there. So I can't stop it. Stop with the sunken place.
Okay.
So then I can't. I think Tommy gave his usual sort of pre-curtain speech. I don't remember. But so the movie starts, and immediately people are already like call and responding. Like,
right.
They were already yelling Denny every time Denny came on camera,
right?
And doing all this different stuff. And it was like, oh, this is already this. Has become like this sort of Rocky Horror cult experience from a movie that has like no real advertising and no studio behind it.
Yeah.
But people have found it and people are goofing on it. And we had a blast. Like it was.
But the Jonah Hills had not yet found it.
But this was
right?
before the Midnight movies started.
Right.
So this was way before the Entertainment Weekly article and way before the Kristen Bells and the Jonah Hills had found this movie.
Right.
Tom and I were like, oh my God, what is this thing? In fact, I have this video.
I remember when you came home and from that screening and told me about it.
Uh-huh.
And you were like, you have to go.
It's like if Ed Wood made a Sundance movie.
Right.
There was some video, some DVD that Tommy was distributing at one point that was about sort of like the history of
audience
the room.
Audience reactions.
Yeah. And there's a shot of Tom and me walking out of that screening room.
Right.
So
we still have that DVD.
We do. Yeah. So the movie then starts playing Midnight.
You bought my DVD. Now buy the DVD of you enjoying my DVD.
I think that was a freebie, actually.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. We bought the Midnight movie started at the Sunset 5, which is up the street from us. And so then, I took a bunch of people, and it was just, and it grew into this thing. And yeah, the comedians started finding it, and EW wrote about it. And The Room became a global phenomenon. People were seeing this movie all over the place. And
a global phenomenon?
Oh, yeah.
Do you see it? Can people watch it in
There was like London countries? Had a very popular run, and in other places.
All right.
And it's a movie that is sort of maybe, it's one of the ultimate examples of what Dave likes to call the zero star movie.
Okay. Yes.
In that it's the half star movie is a crappy movie that's a crappy movie and it's boring. And a zero star movie is like, oh my God, drop everything and go see this thing. You won't believe it.
Now, I have questions.
Okay.
That have never been fully answered by anyone. So, and I'll get to the question in a second. Greg Sestero, who plays...
Mark
in the film, he wrote a book
about called The Disaster Artist.
After the cult had bloomed,
yes.
He wrote a book called The Disaster Artist.
I was just getting there.
And you have listened to the audiobook.
I have.
Unabridged, I assume?
Yes.
Okay. I have not. What I want to know is, does he, in the book... Because we know the mechanics of how this came to be,
how this
phenomenon came to be.
Right.
But what we don't know, what personally I don't know, is how in on this is Mr. Wiseau? Clearly, he is canny enough to know that regardless of the reaction not being what he wanted it to be initially, it's still a reaction and those people are still paying money to see it and buy the DVD.
Right.
How much along the way did he stop? Did he stop and say to himself, oh, I can get an audience for this by playing along? Is that in the book?
Let's stick a pin in that.
Okay.
Because now we should talk about The Disaster Artist, which is the movie version of Greg Sestero's book.
Which is
directed by James Franco, and Franco stars as Tommy Wiseau. And the movie follows the book pretty closely up until the end, but we'll get to that. And it's about how Greg and Tommy met in an acting class in San Francisco, and how Greg was the handsome one, but really shy on stage and really reserved. And Tommy... it was the strange-looking tall guy who didn't really...
He's not that tall.
Well...
I've stood next to him at the post office so many times.
He's taller than Tommy.
He's not that tall.
Taller than Greg. Anyway, but he was this he's an unusual looking person with a strange grasp on the English language and not a particularly deep talent, but totally
not a talent.
There's no talent. But totally fearless on stage.
Right.
And Greg really admired that and wanted to work with him. So the two of them became friends. They moved to Los Angeles together, and eventually Tommy writes a screenplay and gets this movie made. Where does Tommy come from? We still don't know.
Poland is what I hear.
Where did Tommy get the money to make this movie? We still don't know.
My understanding, the best evidence on the internet says Poland.
Right. Look, if we can find out who Angeline really is, I think we need to know who Tommy really is.
It's Angeline?
Angeline, sorry. Please. I always get that wrong.
Come on.
And I'm sure someone is trying to dig that up as we speak. So so the room becomes this this very expensive, like a $6 million movie, because Tommy shoots the whole thing on film and in digital
simultaneously. He has no idea what he's doing.
Yeah. And the movie opens, fails, and then is reborn as this sort of cult comedy item or object. And the one place where I think the movie kind of bobbles it is that it acts like that transition took place on the night of the film's premiere.
That is exactly my... It is a fine comedy, and it's an interesting film about... And a very, very knowing and not condescending film about...
Hollywood dreamers.
What it means to... want to be a part of the film industry and have no actual abilities, but so much drive
right.
that you just wiggle your way through by any means necessary.
Yeah.
And an earnestness that does sort of recall Ed Wood.
Sure.
But yes, but they spend the entire film on that. And they realize, I think, near the end, they've got, oh, wait, now we have to talk about how this film became the thing it became.
Right.
We have 5 minutes to do that. And so what they do is they time compress everything that you just talked about into the opening premiere night audience's reaction, which absolutely did not happen that way. I wasn't there, but it did not happen that way. You see an audience full of people starting at the beginning of the movie, watching it, thinking, oh, this is garbage. And by the end of it, they are behaving like the future cult audience.
Right, and laughing at it.
And laughing at it and enjoying it in spite of its terribleness.
And the reason we know that it wasn't that fast is because the original run of the film, the ads were all a drama in the vein of Tennessee Williams.
Correct.
And it wasn't until the midnight shows later that they had a new trailer and new ads that were like, come see this hilarious black comedy.
Right.
So, yeah, Tommy had no idea that he had made anything funny, which is why it's funny.
Right.
And then at some point hopped on that bandwagon realizing that was going to work. To answer your question, I don't remember if they go into that in the book or not.
Oh, come on now. That's the most important part to me.
Okay.
How I need to know why this guy signed on for that level of self-mockery.
I think he started noticing who was showing up and who was showing up.
People began showing up.
Well, no, but even before that, though, there were people who were going, the people that discovered it in the original run, the people who were in that
those
room.
Those are just a bunch of UCLA kids. Yeah.
Right. But the people who were already in that room ready to see it with Tom and me.
Yeah.
Those guys started going over and over and over again and bringing friends and coming back with more people.
Correct.
So I think fairly early on, he got hip to what was happening.
I need to know the workings of his mind.
Well, that is a great mystery to us all.
Well, but it feels like Greg Sestero would know. Greg Sestero would have had those conversations with him.
And I'm sure
how we can sell this.
I'm sure that is in the book. I listened to the audiobook like 2 years ago.
I guess I'm going to have to do it myself.
I guess you're going to have to.
I suppose I might have
But let's talk about the film. James Franco's performance as Tommy Wiseau, I think, is brilliant.
It really is.
And Nathan Rabin wrote a really good piece that I thought kind of captured, because it really all crystallizes in Tommy's laugh.
Right.
Tommy has the laugh of somebody who has no idea how humor works.
Right.
He just knows that people do laugh, and so he does it, but it's the
wherever
emptiest...
it feels like he thinks it should go.
Yeah. You know, even...
And that's English as a second language.
Yeah. So even in the room when Greg's character, Mark, talks about a woman who, you know, got found out for having too many boyfriends and got beat up she got sent to the hospital... Tommy responds with a ha 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 ha.
And he continues to do so take after take after take because he thinks that's where a laugh
That's a laugh should, line.
That's
yeah.
a laugh line. Yeah.
And you know, and when you see him in person, there is something. It's not just English as a second language. It is human as a second language I think.
Yes.
It's fascinating. But I think that, you know, and I know there are people out there who hate the whole room cult thing and they think it's just punching down.
We have a friend, Mark Hoik.
Yes.
Who's been on the show and has railed against this particular film. He calls it an astroturfed cult phenomenon. And I understand where he's coming from, because when you have the maker of the film actively promoting, like gunning as hard for its cult fame as he did for its
seriousness. Right.
There's somebody turned a corner in his head and said to himself, whatever it takes to make money off this.
But here's
the
thing.
I'll do it.
But there's no guarantee that that's ever going to work. I mean, let's not forget, Showgirls opened, MGM put that movie out.
Yes.
Serious film. New film from Paul Verhoeven.
Yep.
Tanked. Within months, they were like redoing the ads in like a cheetah print.
Right.
And playing it at midnight and getting drag queens to introduce it and like trying to make it that movie.
Right.
Black Swan even did the same thing.
Yeah.
Once the award season was over, like, let's show it at midnight and get some drag queens in there. And it didn't particularly take off with either of those, at least as far as a theatrical experience goes. So you can try.
Because Showgirls is actually a brilliant film.
Right, but I'm just saying.
FYI, that's the official Linoleum Knife stance.
Yes.
Okay.
But you can try to create. I mean, look at Shock Treatment.
Right.
The sequel to Rocky Horror. That's a movie that was designed to be a cult film, and you can't do that.
Right.
You only become a cult film when the audience decides that it is. And so I don't buy the whole AstroTurf thing, because it still could have very easily not happened. And people,
he didn't go out of his way to make a cult film.
Exactly.
He went out to make a film that he believed.
Right, but I'm saying
even though
he reinterprets his film for the cult's benefit,
yes.
There's still no guarantee that cult's going to show up.
I understand.
You know, and the thing is, what I find so fascinating about The Room for me is it's the kind of bad movie that makes you appreciate everything about the filmmaking process, like things that you've just always taken for granted, because any professional competent filmmaker knows how to do it. This movie does not do.
Right.
You know, that's why I made the joke a while.
The Room, but not The Disaster Artist.
Yeah, The Room. Yeah, okay. The Disaster Artist totally knows what it's doing. I made the joke months ago that Trump was the Room of presidents. Because just like the things you take for granted of what a person would know to do or know not to say, it is not happening.
So we both agree this is a good movie. Go see it.
The Disaster Artist.
It's funny. You should probably see The Room first.
You should. You don't have
to,
as it turns out.
Because
Ben Mankiewicz had not.
Okay.
And in fact, when he told us a few days beforehand that he had not seen it, and Chrissy was like, oh, don't see it, and let's see if the movie works for you. And he said it did. Yeah.
I still think it would help if you saw the film first.
Sure.
Because it would give you an understanding of what got made.
And you'll appreciate the beautiful dead-onness with which they recreate.
Yeah, I don't think you can appreciate Franco as Tommy Wiseau.
Without seeing Wiseau in action first. That's true. And certainly not Ari Grainer as Juliette Danielle.
Oh my God. Okay, so thank you for bringing that up, because I'd almost forgotten about her. Juliette Danielle, who plays
Lisa
in The Room, there's an actress named Ari Grainer. She's part of the Judd Apatow world.
She was in For a Good Time Call.
She and Seth Rogen's wife, whose name I am blanking on, They created a comedy about 5-6 years ago called For a Good Time Call.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, a sweet, funny, weird movie about two young women's friendship and the phone sex line business that they start together. And Lauren...
You talk, I'll look it up.
Okay. Anyway, Ari Grainer, you don't see her much. She's around, but she pops up here and there. She's not a household name. She plays Juliet Danielle in this film. And one of the things that happens at the end of the film...
Lauren Miller.
Lauren Miller, that's Rogan's wife's name. Yeah. Okay. She's an actress herself, and etc. Okay, so... At the end of the Disaster Artist, there is a credit sequence where they show you clips from the room.
Side by side.
Side by side, split screen, with the Disaster Artist's recreation of those scenes. And they're all word for word, you know, identical. But Ari Grainer's line reading and performance makes it sound like one voice coming out of the screen, when in reality it's hers and Juliet Danielle's. The inflections, the timing, it's robotically perfect. I don't know how she did this, but she deserves a role that young Streep would get. That is, she is something else. So, anyway, this is a cool movie.
Yeah, the recreations of the room are all pretty dead on. And in fact, there are so many of them. Somebody said on Twitter, I want there to be a DVD extra that is basically James Franco having reshot all of the room.
They must have done this.
It seems like...
They really must have done this. And I hope that that's what we get.
And you know, the movie does leave out one of my favorite anecdotes about the room, which is the actor who disappears midway through and is replaced by somebody else playing a different character but saying the previous character's dialogue. But you can't have everything.
Correct. That's the guy you met.
Yes, in San Diego, Comic-Con.
Yeah.
That is one of my favorite movie person encounter stories. We're walking past this like outdoor cafe, and he's at a table with a couple of women, and I walk past him, and I literally like stopped.
Yeah.
And I walked backwards, and I said, I hate to bother you, but were you in the room? And this was... pretty early in the cycle.
This is a year and a half afterwards. Yeah, 2 years maybe.
Yeah, this was before it had become like the giant phenomenon that it became. And he kind of like put his head in his hands and he said, yes. and I said, all right, so that guy at the end of the movie, that's your dialogue, right? And he goes, yeah, I had to leave midway through and I couldn't come back. And so they just cast somebody else.
They Bela Lugosi'd him.
Yeah, but they don't even try. Like the other character has a different name. Like it's a guy we've never seen before, but is suddenly having these kind of intimate discussions they were having with the psychiatrist character. It's like, wait, who are you?
Yeah, he's the psychiatrist.
Yeah, no, I mean, who's the new
soap
guy?
Soap opera replacement day.
No, but
today
it's
he'll be played by.
But it's not even like there's another Darren.
I get it. I understand.
Yeah. Disaster Artist. It's a who.
In a completely different direction, I saw the documentary Bombshell.
Yes, tell me about it.
Well, Hedy Lamarr was a big star in the 30s and 40s.
Yes.
And she was also a scientist. And... Hollywood did not know what to do about that, what to do with her, so they ignored it.
Right.
She was billed as the most beautiful woman in the world, and she was stunning.
Yes. She was a contender for that title, no question.
But she was in, you know, like Ziegfeld Girl, and she was in, you know, a bunch of stuff.
She's in like one of the Pepe Lamoco movies, right? Like
yes.
Whatever the remake with Charles Boyer, the Casbah?
I think so.
Yeah.
I could be wrong. In any case, huge screen star, huge movie star.
Yes.
30s and 40s. During World War II, she was from Austria and a Jewish family.
Snuck out in her maid's uniform with her jewels sewn into the lining.
Yeah, yeah. She escaped, came to the United States. And during World War II, she always had this hobby of inventing things. And on her movie sets, she'd go to her trailer with her little,
Soldering
yeah, her
iron.
little inventing tools, and everyone around her just thought, oh, well, that's just her cute little hobby.
Isn't that adorable?
She invented Wi-Fi. She helped work on a technology for the Allies, for the Allied defense against the Nazis. She helped work on a technology that broke the ability of the Nazis to jam frequencies.
Right.
She came up with a code switching situation where they could block the message for like a second, but not enough to block the whole thing.
Because it was going on various different
And it
frequencies.
was going, it, like a chunk would go on one frequency and then another frequency and another frequency. And so, kind of like, and I watched this with Robbie, and he was like, I don't understand what she invented. I said, think about it like this. Someone shoots a gun at you, and instead of running straight away from the bullet, you serpentine. That's what she invented. She
Gotcha.
invented an ability for, the bullet to hit you and just go right through you and, maybe take out an organ, but you're not going to die.
That's a great explanation,
Yeah,
anyway.
you're gonna a little bit of the message is going to get lost, but not all of it, and it can get through.
Right.
This is the technology that became Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
She even gave up her patent.
Hmm.
She had her patent. It expired. She didn't apply to get it back. She was like, here's my gift to the war effort. She was so patriotic for the United States. And then she never got credit. And, she invented other things. She was literally a scientist as well as being like the most glamorous movie star around. And then she got old, and Hollywood didn't care anymore.
Right.
And then she helped plastic surgeons with new techniques. She
To
said
minimize
to
scarring.
minimize scarring or to hide the scarring, so much so that it became sort of common practice
Right.
among Hollywood plastic surgeons. Give me the Hedy Lamarr. Whatever you did to Hedy Lamarr, do that to me. And then she became a recluse and just.
Didn't she sue Mel Brooks over Hedley Lamarr
I
and
don't
Blazing
know if she
Saddles?
did. I don't remember if that's in the movie or not, but
Okay.
she was a fascinating person and so smart that the guys that run the world didn't know what to do with her,
Right.
so they just ignored the fact that she was smart. The film opens, it's a documentary by Alexandra Dean. The film opens with a quote from her where she says, and I'm paraphrasing, it's easy to be glamorous. It's easy to be glamorous. You just have to stand there and look like you're stupid. Pretend to be stupid. Which, I guess, to get by and to get her career, she allowed that to be the case.
Right.
When in reality, she was helping win World War II and invent modern technology.
Wow.
Formally, this is not the best documentary I've ever seen.
But the story's so good.
But the information, the story is so amazing and ultimately, unfortunately, sad because, her she had, kids, the kids, tended to her as she aged. But, the money ran out
Yeah.
and people forgot her and she didn't want to be known anymore. She wanted to be sort of tucked away and
That's there are some actresses of that generation who, like Garbo, obviously famously,
Right.
went away from the limelight. Jean Arthur,
Yes.
After a certain period, like never made public appearances. In fact, she rather famously, at one of the very first USA film festivals in Dallas, they honored Frank Capra, and she came,
Yeah.
but only under the proviso that no photographs be taken.
Right.
And that was before everybody had a dang camera in their phone,
Right.
so no photographs were taken. No
Right.
photographs exist of that
Dorothy
Q&A.
Malone does the same thing, doesn't she? She's still around.
Yeah, she'll serve us every so often. I mean, right. not so but much more, since...
Mostly, though, she just kind of tends to keep to herself.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, watch this. It's so heartbreaking and also inspiring because you see a person who actively fought against being pigeonholed.
Right.
And it was doubly difficult for her because of the fact that she was a woman.
Yeah.
And the fact that she was...
a sex symbol.
A sex symbol, yeah. Anyway, that's it.
Yeah.
Watch it.
Is that everything this week?
No, it's not. You have 60 seconds to talk about Wonder Wheel.
Oh, brother.
All right.
Okay.
Starting now.
On the plus side, it is beautifully shot by Vittorio Storaro.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of it on the plus side. I mean, the acting is, you know, Kate Winslet is doing her best with this material. This is a movie that feels like with a tiny bit of tweaking, it would be like a parody of bad post-World War II drama. And instead it just sort of is one. Kate Winslet plays a has-been actress with dreams, and she's working at a clam shack on Coney Island, and she's having an affair with a lifeguard played by Justin Timberlake, who narrates the film and talks about how he wants to be a great writer, and so he loves poetry and symbolism.
All right.
You know, and then she's married to Jim Belushi, who runs the carousel and is trying to quit drinking, mm-hmm. and his daughter, Winslet's stepdaughter, played by Juno Temple, shows up, and of course, Justin Timberlake falls for her. As Sam Adams points out, not only is this a movie about a guy who decides he prefers the stepdaughter of the woman he's sleeping with to the woman he's sleeping with,
uh-huh.
it's another movie after Blue Jasmine in which the lead woman does something terrible to her man and then winds up crazy and alone.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's all you need to know about Wonder Wheel.
What's your DVD pick?
My DVD pick this week is a movie we reviewed when it was new, but it's now on Blu-ray, and so, you know, definitely out there for everybody, and that is Better Watch Out. The holiday horror comedy from this year, starring Levi Miller and Patrick Warburton and Virginia Madsen, and if you're a Stranger Things fan, Decray Montgomery, who right. plays the sexy, creepy new guy in town, is in this one as well. And it's funny, and it's scary, and it's unpredictable. And yeah, you should see it.
I have chosen my post-Christmas watch.
Okay.
That week after Christmas, we tend to have glorious amounts of...
nothing to do.
Downtime, where we get to lie around and eat and take naps and
stay in our pajamas
and there are no screenings going on,
right,
no deadlines going on, and it's just, you know, the only work we're going to do is this. We're going to sit at this microphone, we're going to talk to you guys, but I am going to watch a film, a 2015 Japanese film called Happy Hour, has finally arrived on DVD. And that's actually the title in Japanese as well. Happy Awa is just a phonetically spelled title. It's from Rusuki Hamaguchi. That's the director. It came out in 2015. It played some film festivals. It played some museums. It had a one-week run in New York City at MoMA.
Okay.
Every day at 4:30 p.m. for 1 week.
Why at 4:30 p.m., Dave?
It's 5.5 hours long.
Oof.
I read a review that Manola wrote,
mm-hmm.
and I read a review that Richard Brody wrote.
Oh.
I'm a fan of Mr. Brody's writing.
I'm not always a fan of his opinion, but I'm a fan of his writing.
They always agree, Mr. Brody and Ms. Dargis.
That is true. They do not.
And they agree on this.
Okay.
And they both think it's great. In fact, Manola is quoted on the box. And it never played anywhere else in the United States because How do you book a 5.5 hour movie in your theater? Like, I think it's always kind of funny when the new Wiseman documentary shows up and gets a theatrical release.
Right.
Well, Ex Libris, 3.5 hours long about a public library, and you go.
We've talked about Asian art house having a hard enough time in Los Angeles.
Right.
5.5 hour Asian art house. Forget it.
It's a story of four women in their 30s, four mm-hmm. friends, and their lives and how they interact with each other. If you wanted to, I guess you could watch it over the course of like 5 days, like it was a TV show with 5 episodes or whatever. Or you could, you know, gun it all in one day.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
I'm going to do that.
Okay.
I'm very excited that this is finally available for anybody who wants to see it. And they sent a copy to our house, which makes me double happy.
I will give it a shot with you.
Christmas. It's Christmas for me.
All right. Lettuce.
I got some.
Lettuce and tomato.
And here we are with letters.
We probably have an all letters episode.
Oh, we have more than one.
Coming up. Because
we'll probably do that over Christmas,
too. Yeah.
This is from...
To close out the books for the
year. This is from Andrew in Australia. There's been a vague, ongoing discussion about when is the right time to discuss the Oscar potential for films. For the Oscar watchers out there, the day after the awards ceremony is held is open season for guessing what will be the next best picture.
Indeed.
Many others feel that a month or two before nominations is only when discussions can take place. The question I have is, when do you feel the opening of the Oscar discussion period is? I have an answer. Never.
I was going to say, for me, I give zero hoots.
I just don't care. Now, when I say I just don't care, that is not to say that I don't care about the Academy Awards broadcast.
We'll watch.
Academy Awards Day, I stay in my pajamas. I do not leave my home because Los Angeles traffic becomes a show.
Yes.
And I make a big bucket of pasta.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever happens to be at my home gets to eat it while we watch the Academy Awards.
And I often live tweet
it. I watch the red carpet. I like the outfits. I like the award show format. I enjoy myself. But I don't care about
handicapping,
right. I had one of the funniest things that ever happened to me at movies.com was the year they decided that I was going to be a gold derby voter. They said, oh, this is really going to sell. This is going to really push the site. Like, people are going to go to the site because of you voting with Gold Derby. So the dude who runs Gold Derby got in contact with me, and he's like, okay, cast your votes, and blah, 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 blah. And so I do it. And then 2 weeks later, or 3 weeks later, he's like, you need to go change your votes. And I was like, why? He's like, because they move up and they move down, and you change your mind, and you handicap things, and you decide, like, you know, the strategy of this movie over this movie. And I go, no. Why would I do that? Because I've already chosen. I have decided.
Because Dave, somebody wins a Golden Globe or the Whisper campaign takes off. It's all different.
I have decided already. And he's like, no, but we need you to do this. And I was like, okay, fine. So I just like
scrambled.
I shuffled a few things around. And at that point I thought, I just don't care. I just don't care. I'll just put anything in these categories. Next year. And this guy, I can't even remember the guy's name, and it's fine. He's not a bad dude. But I just wasn't doing what he needed.
Yeah.
And I didn't know I was supposed to do what he needed.
Right.
And my editor didn't know. And the next year, my editor goes, hey, I just reached out to blah, blah from Gold Derby. So I'll put you back in contact with him.
Crickets.
Like, he was like, oh, I remember you. No.
You're making a mockery of the sacred process.
Apparently I was not. And you know, he was right. He's got his own gig doing this thing, and that's important to them. And the people who want to participate in that, great.
But yeah,
I just don't. It doesn't interest me.
Well, right, exactly.
As a conversation.
If there are people that make a year-long living at Oscar punditry.
Yeah.
More power to them. Obviously, there's people who are interested in that stuff. What drives me crazy are the people who confuse that process and that gamesmanship and the ultimate results with quality and with an unassailable mark of quality. Like, oh, if you're nominated, it means this about your movie.
Right.
If you win, it definitely means this about your movie. It's like, no. No, great movies get ignored by the Academy all the time, and cruddy movies, for one reason or other, get in there because of things that have nothing to do with actual aesthetics.
So it's kind of two different things. It's sports statistics for movie nerds.
Totally.
And that's fun. People like that. It's fun for people.
It's rotisserie baseball.
And I... I'm not interested. And I don't say this because I want to sound snooty or whatever. It's not, oh, I'm above this.
It's just not your jam.
It's just, I don't, you know. I've got cookies to bake. This is really weird.
Which you also do on Oscar.
I have to go bake some cookies. So, I love to talk about the films that I think are great and that deserve attention. And so, if a film like that gets an Oscar nomination, then I'm gung-ho for that movie, because what that means is that more people will see that movie.
Sure. No, look, believe me, I was delighted that Moonlight won last year, because it was the first time, I think, ever in my life that my pick of the best film of the year and the Academy's overlapped.
They coincided. Yeah. So the letter continues.
Oh.
Also, is this continued Oscar discussion good for the analysis of films? And in turn, is the Oscar release season something that will start to fade away? I don't think it's good for, like Alonzo just said, discussions of quality, necessarily, although it can be. And I don't think it's going to fade away.
No. It doesn't show any signs of waning.
There's no indication that's going to happen. He continues, after all, the notion that January and February were dumping ground months for films being challenged with high earning, high quality films being released then. That's true, because the people who are releasing good movies in January and February that are not Oscar contenders, that are genuinely 2018 films that should be remembered later in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using 2018 as an example for next year. They realize there's a hole in the market then, because you've got garbage movies coming out in January and February, and you've got 2017's Oscar favorites and Oscar nominated films coming out then
to the rest of the country.
To the rest of the country. But those movies don't necessarily turn out to be big box office films. They're quality films that are still often, very often, particularly now, niche market kind of
Screening for an ever shrinking adult movie audience.
Right. So then you wind up with something like, I don't know, when did Deadpool come out? Did Deadpool come out?
In February.
Yeah. So there's a big, big crowd pleasing, good movie.
Yeah.
That's not going to get any, you know, Academy love, but it's going to get an audience. It's going to get money.
Yeah. Like,
and it's going to get critical attention from people, you know, that'll say, oh, yeah, yeah, no, go see this. It's
like Logan this year was like March.
Logan. Right? Yeah. Stuff like that.
But and then at the same time, you had a movie like Personal Shopper opening at the beginning of the year, which traditionally would be the kind of thing you would expect to see in award season. But I think they just figured, if they didn't nominate Kristen Stewart for Clouds of Sils Maria, they're not going to nominate her for this one.
And I think that they very wisely understood that Personal Shopper was going to divide even art house audiences.
Sure.
And
it was not an Academy-friendly movie by any
means. Not at all.
Means.
Not at all. So, continuing. I personally love diving into Oscar discussions and thinking about potential winners, but I can't help feeling that for some films, they have a heightened level of expectations to be award-worthy, when really they may just be a good film, such as The Big Sick or Battle of the Sexes.
Well, you know, I think The Big Sick is probably going to get at least an original screenplay nomination.
Probably.
And maybe Holly Hunter. You know, it's a possibility.
Maybe.
You know, but it gets into this weird thing of what's the tail and what's the dog. I think that some movies only get seen because of their perceived Oscar ability, you know, and that's why they get pushed in that fashion. And then other movies, you know, I mean, Big Sick came out in the summer, You know, but I think is a movie that, but not only critically acclaimed but financially successful is what makes it an Oscar contender, because a lot of times, you know, that's sort of your reward for a nice solid mid-level indie hit is you get that screenplay nomination.
Right. And he continues, also, for fear of going on for too long, is it possible that with the new members of the Academy and the end of the Weinstein era, that finally the Best Picture Award will be for a film that genuinely deserves the award and not a congratulatory backpatting we love ourselves trophy?
Well, this past year was that already.
Yeah.
I would say Moonlight was totally that. we'll see what...
I'm just reading silently as you're talking.
It'll be interesting to see what the first post-Weinstein Oscars will be like.
This letter comes from October 31st, and he says, hopefully, if I've timed sending this letter correctly, it will be read at or around the beginning of the Oscar season.
Well played, sir.
Thank you, Andrew from Australia, who, by the way, has the AB Film Review
right.
podcast.
And who also submitted a Stump Alonso question to Who Shot Ya. I think I answered it, though.
Yeah. Clint says, I've been busy, and I finally had enough time to go through my backlog of LK episodes, and I'm so glad to hear that you both enjoyed Geostorm. I really thought I was losing my mind for enjoying this movie. My only issue with it was regarding the destruction of Rio de Janeiro. All the men on the beach were wearing board shorts, not a Speedo in sight. True. That is a problem. However, when they showed the destruction of a beach in Dubai, several men were wearing Speedos. Would that even be possible, considering their decency laws? I have no idea.
Good question.
I don't know what the Mankini law is in Dubai. I also saw It, and I wasn't a fan for a couple of reasons. I felt like the movie's only purpose was to set up future sequels and prequels. Hmm. And the movie wants to have a character who is overtly racist, but is never called out for their racism.
Yeah, I remember there is a weirdly blobby thing there where he never says the N-word.
Right, right. I remember Alonso stating in an aside that this racism strained credulity. Hmm. I didn't really think more about this topic until I was on a road trip and stopped at a Barnes & Noble. There was an entire section dedicated to Stephen King's oeuvre. Bring me the special hors d'oeuvre. The apple. And it included the new version of the It book in order to tie in the movie. I opened up to I've opened up the book to a random page, and the N-word appeared 3 times. Now I know that the movie's racism plot was complete BS. Thank you, Clint.
Hmm.
Thank you, Clint. And here is a letter from Wilson, who says, I will now open myself up to jump scares until such time as I become bored as well. Oh, and I think the difficult films for bears are suggestions for the difficult film night bear social group in Seattle that wrote in earlier. Yes, I had
forgotten.
I had completely forgotten. Unfortunately, I have a problem in my brain. The minute I'm done with this show, everything that I said gets erased from my mind.
Mm.
And I forget that I ever said it. And if I go back and listen to an old episode just randomly, and that almost never happens, it's like another human being is talking to me and it's not me.
Right.
Because I'm, listen to me. Oh, aren't I smart? Oh, I'm an idiot. Oh, I did say that thing, didn't I? Anyway.
Yeah, I'm always like, dummy, you forgot to mention blah, 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 blah.
Thank you, Wilson. Okay, we're done.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I'm doing a ton of podcasts these days because of Christmas. So go check out the latest. I'm on Battleship Pretension. The first of my 2 appearances this month on Fat Guys of the Movies is up. I have taped an episode of All Things Cozy that should be dropping in the next couple of weeks. I will be posting links to all of these on the Linoleum Knife Facebook page. So if you want to hear more of my blather, go there and find out where. Check out our other friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com and cancel too soon. And
ChristyLemire.com.
Cancel Too Soon and Bibbs and Whitney's new podcast, critically acclaimed over at the Schmoes Know Network. And, of course, check out the Schmoes Know. And Dennis Henman with Dennis Hensley, the Comics Canon, the Sewers of Paris, Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe for free at iTunes. Oh, I forgot to send you. We have a ton of new five-star reviews.
Oh, good.
So next episode we'll read those. But thank you, everybody who left those. Y'all are awesome. Please keep it up, folks, because it does help people find the show.
It helps us.
You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and Lounge.com and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music, Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. Drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. It's also where you can PayPal us.
For a black t-shirt that has the words Linoleum Knife on it in white letters.
Or
stark and awesomely.
Or
we have all the sizes except for like double X.
I think you said
right
yeah.
now. Or what?
Or you can become a club member
yes.
at patreon.com/linoleumknife.
And if you go there, you'll see all of the explanation as to what that means. There's an adorable video.
That's
where
right.
Where we tell you everything. There's all the levels that you can join at. We're not going to bore you with that right now.
It's all there on the website.
It's all there on the page.
So, again, sorry this one was late, but we'll be back on schedule this weekend.
Well, maybe we will, because that's another packed weekend. So,
right.
you know,
December,
don't count
folks.
On us, is all what right. I'm trying to say.
One way or another.
It'll happen. It just might not happen the way it normally happens.
We're going to get you.
A regular weekend. It's a Sunday morning, and we got it all together, and we're not being pulled in seven directions. But this is December, and that's different.
All bets are off.
Yeah.
Anyway, until next time.
Goodbye.